Shrink Wrap Radio number 579, The Body of Sex, with Sarah Burden.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is visionary sex educator and workshop leader, Sarah Burden. For more information about Sarah Burden, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here is the interview. Sarah Burden, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, I'm really happy to have you on the show. I was not familiar with your work, but one of my listeners, Eric Shanks, recommended you so highly, so passionately, that I just felt, okay, I've got to go ahead and interview this person. And I also saw that you did a TEDx presentation in St. Louis, which congratulations on that. I think that's a real accomplishment to be involved in any way with TED. I'm so impressed with that.
Thank you.
Service.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to focus on, I gather you are many things, but we're going to focus on your role as a sex educator, and evidently a different kind of sex educator. And so I'll be very interested to find out all about that. In fact, a place for us to start might be to ask you, how did you become a sex educator? I can't imagine a little girl sitting around thinking to herself, when I grow up, I want to be a sex educator.
True. That did not happen. You know, my work in the realm of sex and sexuality, I think, has been a real outgrowth from my personal life and interest and evolution as a woman. And my background for years has been as an educator, and I've always been an experiential educator, mostly working in realms of the body, of somatic healing and wilderness. Nature-based work. And my personal path, I think, you know, as an adolescent and moving into young adulthood, into my college years, all the way into my 30s, I think the topic of sex and sexuality for me was sort of this this internal world that I had yet to find what I considered to be trustworthy mentorship around, and some kind of guidance that matched or led me into the depth to which I felt my own sexuality moving in me. And acknowledging that it's a complex territory, that it's a complex territory in intimate partnerships, in body work, in as we move through the world. It's kind of one of those stones that seems to be left unturned, especially in spiritual development. And as well as sort of in the dominant culture, I couldn't really find a place that I felt like I fit in. And I had dabbled in, you know, I dabbled in different realms or sort of different pathways of exploring different teachings and different lineages, and essentially continued to walk away with a feeling that in order to be more sexually empowered, more sexually awake, more true to my own sexual energy as it was moving through me, that I was continually walking away feeling like I was being asked to be something different than what I actually felt like I was as this woman in this body, whether that was to express more sexually with different people or, you know, there was something in that territory that never totally rang true in my bones in terms of what I had come across.
One of the things that comes to mind is tantric sexuality and all the teaching around that. Was that one of the things that you explored?
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually feel like capable of speaking to tantra in its fullness. Like, I couldn't say what is tantra. It's huge.
Yeah.
It's a huge, vast, old lineage. But what I do feel like I encountered were certain branches of sort of modern day tantra or neo tantra traditions. And there, you know, and I want to be really respectful here and really careful, because what I'm not giving a blanket statement about tantra at all. I don't know enough about it. All I know is that the paths that I encountered and the teachers that I encountered and the group atmospheres that I encountered in that realm, tantra was a part of that. There were other things that were a part of that. There was something that didn't resonate for me, and something that felt like was deeply missing for me in a kind of depth and internal power and kind of refinement in what I came across. So I want to speak with a lot of respect for tantra as a lineage, and I cannot make a blanket statement about that at all.
I think that our culture is so obsessed with sex, and that as it would come through through our people, that it might well be distorted and self-serving and exploitative. And that's my take from very much afar. Mm-hmm. But that would be, if I try to read into what you're saying, that's kind of what's coming up for me.
Yeah, I appreciate the way you're speaking that, because it feels to me like that often in the realm of sexual awakening, it's an outgrowth of certain levels of trauma that are in the culture, that are in this, you know, is in all of our lineages in certain ways. And it's sort of like in the effort to come into a more awakened, aligned sexuality, I think we are only human, right? And the outgrowth of that can sort of be a trickle down of our own relationship with that, and the huge force that is the collective dominant energy surrounding sex and sexuality in the United States.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a pendulum swing from repression, deep repression, and sort of puritanical roots to the other end of that spectrum, which is a hyper objectified, pornographic, highly pressured expression and articulation of sex.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad we're getting into the bigger picture here, because I know that's an important context for what you're doing. You said that you were looking for the right feeling, sort of mentorship. Did you find that? And if so, where?
I did. And it felt like a total miracle to me. It was sort of, you know, that question around sex and sexuality, I'd sort of put on a shelf to say, I might not find that pathway in a way that feels true to me in this life. Mm. And I found a teacher who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I studied with them about 5 years ago. And I encountered, my teacher's name is Zhenzan Dao and the Moga Dao lineage. And there was something in the way I encountered Zhenzan as a teacher and in the practices and the atmosphere of teaching that to me felt like my first brush with absolute integrity in the sexual sphere, in a room, you know, working deeply with the cultivation of sexual energy, but that what the atmosphere in the room was not sexualized at all. It was a very deep tapping into fundamental energy and rooted in Qigong lineage and Qigong practices that have really deep roots in Taoist culture. And, you know, I spent the first 2 days of that workshop weeping, because what I felt was that I had encountered what to me felt like a homecoming. And that what was happening in the teachings was that I was being returned to myself
Wow.
again
Yeah.
and again and again. in no way asked to step outside of myself, or in order to be more sexually awake, I needed to become other than the woman that I am in this body that moves through me in the way that I do. And there was also something in the forms. So archetypal Qigong forms that are original to the Mogadao tradition that engendered a kind of archetypal power and sensitivity in my body that to me felt like, oh, this is the woman I know myself to be inside. Mm. This is the woman that I don't see sort of a play, like I don't know what to do with this woman in the world. And I don't think that's unique to me. I think there are, that we walk around with a sense of ourselves and a sense of depth and truth and sensitivity and love and appreciation for beauty and a sense into the power that lies in our sexual realm. And then we look out into the world and we're not sure where it fits. And so instead of maintaining a kind of, you know, like holding true to what we know inside, it's so easy to get swept up in the cultural river to say, well, there's no place for that here, so I'll conform to this. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, leading to a tremendous amount of deep, what I would call soul starvation, incredible sexual hunger that does not come, a sort of sexual longing and a desire to be known in the depth of our sexuality, to express the depth of our sexuality in a way that matches and mirrors who we know ourselves to be in the quietest moments of ourselves.
Okay, of course, this is evoking a lot of curiosity on my part. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll get satisfied as we go along. I'm curious whether this mentor, male or female?
So when I studied with Zhenzan was a male-identifying male 5 years ago.
Okay.
And Zhenzan went into a period of silence for a year and a half and withdrew from teaching for several years and had a incredibly deep transformative experience in that and emerged from that silence as a transgendered individual that felt very, very true to who they were in their own original energy and their own expression. So Zhenzan now is a transgender and beautifully holding, you know, the masculine and feminine that has come from, you know, a lifetime of cultivation of the balance of those energies.
Yeah, so there must have been something stirring for that person for a long time, and it took a while to flower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the work that you do in colleges. Because I know that you have traveled around the country a lot, I guess, and been invited to be a presenter at various colleges. I'm not even sure how that happens. I mean, you know, you don't have like a PhD in sex education or anything like that. So how has this come to be?
So my work on college campuses, to me, has been sort of this convergence of all the threads I've been following for my whole life. And it came together in a single classroom, in a single instant, where I recognized what was happening, which was an incredible call that met a lifetime of a development of certain skills to sort of meet that need. So my background has been as an educator, wilderness-based, international development educator. I've worked with young people for my whole life, as well as adults. Part of my work has been working with a company called Where There Be Dragons, and we lead international education and cultural immersion programs in developing countries. And I also have a background in anthropology. And so from, you know, early years in college, my interest was in culture and reading between the lines and seeing culture wherever I went, whether that was, you know, to a coffee shop in Portland or to a village in Indonesia. And I began working with dragons and leading trips in India and Indonesia with high school and gap year aged students. So students,
how exciting.
High school and college, really extraordinary, very transformative programming. And so after, you know, several years of working for dragons, what I had was a collection of students I was very close to that were now in college, that we'd shared these many month experiences and deep transformative educational moments. And one of those students, a really dear student named Naya Herman, invited me to her school, to Colorado College, to give a lecture. And she knew I was studying and teaching sexuality work. And we had, you know, just a really trusted relationship. And she said, hey, will you come and give a lecture at my school? And this was in, so this was in November of 2015. About a year prior is when sexual assault on college campuses really took fire in headlines across the United States. There had been studies that had come out that said, you know, sexual assault reports on college campuses between 2009 and 2014 had risen by 1,000%. And the White House at that point in 2014 took that report incredibly seriously and created a task force for the prevention of sexual assault. So, you know, in a turn of a tide that took about a year, we all of a sudden have the White House putting forward compliance standards for colleges and campuses really looking at what's happening with the rise in reports on their campus and the sexual culture on their campuses. So Naya invited me to her school to give a lecture. It was Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and I gave a lecture to a group of students, many of whom were survivors of trauma, essentially offering them a different paradigm for sexuality and how to relate to sex, to their bodies, how to work with decision making, how to reclaim agency and empowerment after experiences of sexual trauma, how to learn to sense into themselves, and ultimately a real message around them being able to trust themselves. And, you know, my background at that point is in the Mogadell work, but one of my, you know, skills is translating that for younger people or people who aren't necessarily interested in sacred Taoist sexuality, but are in an experience in their sex and their relationships where they know something's not working. And it was in this lecture, David, that it hit me like a ton of bricks. And it came to me through the questions that came after this lecture and the line of students that went almost to the door that sat with me one by one to thank me, but to tell me their stories and to ask me questions and to let me know what they felt like was happening on campus. And what I realized was we were, you know, that school at that moment, I knew this was not the only school that this could be happening at. That we were an entire country having a conversation about sexual assault on college campuses, but that we weren't talking about sex. That at the end of the day, these students had real questions about what happened on Friday night. Why have I been depressed for 6 months since a sexual interaction that I don't understand what happened? Experiences for students who gave consent and yet still walked away feeling violated and not being able to make sense of that. And really seeing that there was a huge response on campus, and rightly so, for a real refinement of reporting procedures, legislation, holding students accountable for sexual behavior that did not have integrity, activism, Take Back the Night, rallies, but nowhere in there were there real spaces for students to understand what was actually possible inside of sex so that that could serve as a like a measuring stick for them around the kind of interactions that they were having. That nowhere did they have any clue what else was possible. So they were willing to essentially take what they could get, endure whatever was happening, and walking away thinking that's sex. And on, you know, on one end of that spectrum, that is consensual sexual interactions between two people possibly who aren't really interested in each other, but feeling the tremendous pressure to have sex, mm-hmm. the social scene, the peer pressure, and having consensual sex, but waking up the next morning and feeling horrible about it. Having a sense inside, literally feeling sick to their stomachs and not understanding why. And that is a feeling and an experience that students don't keep in the bedroom. They walk that out onto campus the next day. That runs like a tape in their mind, in their classes. That comes into them every time they see that person in the dining hall. And they sit in their quiet moments and they wonder what's wrong with them sexually. And how come they can't just, you know, be okay with what's happening, meanwhile not understanding what could actually be possible. And then on the other end of that spectrum, you know, younger generations right now are in the influence of something very new, which is digital pornography. That was not a teacher of sex in the way that it is now. It wasn't for us as it is now.
Right.
And
right.
So
that's a huge, huge impactor on, for young people who are looking for some kind of guidance.
Yes.
And, this is what it's supposed to be like?
Exactly.
So I could see where there would be a lot of stuff around that. I had a male teaching assistant, undergraduate teaching assistant, and he shared, you know, we got close and he shared some stuff for me. And he would talk about, there didn't seem to be any, quotes, dating that I grew up with. There weren't dating relationships, you know, kind of leading up to some kind of sexual relationship. Rather, he would talk about, well, you go to a party and you hook up.
Right.
And, you know, that was the expression, was hook up. And it didn't feel like there was any emotional commitment at all or investment.
I mean, that's a term on campus right now that I learned when I was touring campuses, is hookup culture. I had no idea this term existed. And I was like,
I didn't either. Yeah.
And it's essentially, like a very casual sex without, you know, commitment or any emotional investment. And, you know, it's almost seen as a term I heard on one campus is it's cool to be cold. Mm. Like even the experience, even expressing interest or wanting something more, or even wanting, you know, to further explore sexual relationship, is a huge taboo. That it's like we hook up and then we basically pretend like that didn't happen. You know, I was in one room at Wesleyan University and there were probably 75 students in this room. And at a certain point in the lecture, they all kind of looked around at each other. And it was like the cat was out of the bag, that everyone was sort of pretending that they were cool with hookup culture, that they were okay with that. And they started looking around and they were like, this is crazy. Like, what are we doing? What's up with the, I pretend I don't even know you in the dining hall. What's up with the, like, don't even text you back, you know? And they started looking around and it was like this huge breath of fresh air that entered the room where they were like, we're not really into this either, but it's what's happening. And what's the alternative? Or, you know, the fear of being ridiculed for saying that they want to move a relationship into a sexual encounter into a relationship. Or
what an amazing thing to open up.
It was an amazing moment.
And I'm struck by how fresh all of this is for you too. I mean, you're saying it started in 2015. And yet it's this coming together of issues that you've been thinking about and working with in yourself for a long time.
Yeah.
And now you're the right person in the right place at the right time, it seems.
Yeah, it does. And it's it's an amazing, it's been a really interesting thing to kind of see that is happening.
Yeah. So, I mean, what are the questions they're asking you when they're lining up at the door? The lecture's over.
Mm-hmm. Lecture's over. You know, I started to tell this story in the TEDx that I gave, but I didn't tell it fully. But this student impacted me so deeply there was a woman who came and she sat down and she said, I don't understand. She said, I get really anxious around sex, like so anxious it's debilitating. And I don't know how to get rid of my anxiety. Can you tell me, like, help me understand this? Mm-hmm. And so I inquired, I said, tell me a little bit more about what's happening for you. And she started explaining that there was a guy on campus that they'd been texting for a few days, and it felt like it was about to move into, they were going to have sex. Like the next time, like that was where all the texting was going, was like, come over and let's have sex. And she said, the closer I get to feeling like it's going to happen, the more nervous and anxious I get. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And this is where I said to her that, did you ever wonder if your anxiety was trying to tell you something? Was trying to tell you that you were moving too quickly? Was trying to tell you that going from texting to having sex after really never even spending time with this person, that your body was giving you signals to say that is too fast and that is not what like feels right to me? Mm-hmm. And I said, your anxiety is the best thing you've got going for you right now. It is giving you so much information and there is nothing wrong with you. What you are tuned into is your instinct and your intuition and something deeper that's moving in you. And she started crying and she said, I have never had anybody tell me that I could, number one, trust my body or trust my emotions. And you're exactly right. Like I'm freaking out because I push myself to have sex with people immediately, because that's what I feel like I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so this is a girl who's walking around with that level of anxiety. And inside, like that for me, I was like, we are literally teaching young people to ignore their bodies, to think that there's something wrong with them for having intuition and instinct rise up, and to do everything in their power to make it go away. And in a sexual interaction, that especially on college campuses, the best way to start dulling instinct and intuition is with alcohol and substances. Yeah. Alcohol and substances are totally a symptom of something underneath. And then the girl behind her came up and she said, I am a freshman. I went to a party when I first got on campus. It was sort of the end of the night. I was really drunk. I looked around. There were only a couple guys left in the room. And so I chose one of them and basically made myself have sex with them, because that's what you do. You go to a party on a weekend and you go home with somebody different. You hook up with someone new. And I woke up in the morning and nothing has been the same since. I feel horrible about myself. I said yes. And so I don't understand why I feel so horrible. And I mean, this young woman, 6 months into her freshman year of college, feeling like the social pressures every single weekend are such that are causing her to have to drink so much alcohol, hook up with people. And then like none of this stays in the bedroom. This is an epidemic moving out into every sphere of those students' lives. And that is, I feel like, one of the most important things for us to understand is like sex is not a compartment. The sexual health of our students on college campuses is integral to who they are in every other like arena of their life. This is like inner torture and sadness and depression and self-doubt that then is moving everywhere on a campus.
How might that play out in other areas of their lives?
Well, I think it's one of, you know, I remember, I was at Middlebury College and speaking to a woman, and she said, the interesting thing is we can be like rocking it in academics, groups on campus, sports, but in the most personal facet of our lives, which is our sexuality, we feel like we're fundamentally broken. And so there's this feeling of like high success in all of the outer realms, academia, all of those things, but then a kind of deep personal torment that happens that affects the way they're able to move into intimate relationships, that affects the way they're telling the truth about anything in their lives, because it's like this secret that we hold where we don't understand what happens there, but then we kind of keep it under wraps. And then ultimately, that is a snowball effect that affects every other sexual interaction. The amount of fear or shame or I won't talk about that, and the kind of dissociation that happens in their bodies during sexual encounters. But I mean, I think we know, like, you have sex on Friday night with someone who you maybe really like. You wake up the next morning and you're thinking about it. And you're thinking about it all day. And then you're thinking about it Sunday and Monday. And that person is walking around campus. And what are all the little things inside that you have to do to essentially pretend that didn't happen or make yourself safe in the face of something that felt so incongruent without any place to understand what happened?
You know, what you're saying makes some of the films and TV series that are popular now make more sense to me, because because the characters in those that are presented, I guess, as heroes, you know, like I'm thinking of the series Girls that I never really got into, but it has that quality. The interactions have this quality that you're talking about of a kind of a major disconnect and a major cynicism, a major kind of, I don't care, nothing's worth caring about, and I'm above it.
Right. And that fundamental, like, dissociation at that level, that then makes it more possible for us to say yes to a job we don't really want, to force ourselves to do things in all of the outgrowth, further out areas of our lives, because we think we're supposed to, and because we're okay with forcing ourselves to do things that ultimately don't feel true or right to us. Mm-hmm. And that there are entire industries, corporations, families built on that. Do you know what I mean? The outgrowth of that is like my job, my marriage, what I do with my day, my friendships. Sure. And the kind of deep pain that we walk around with in this fundamental sphere.
Got a couple of questions rattling around and having trouble grabbing them. What about the male side of the equation? You've kind of spoken to the female side. Tell us about what it's like for young guys. What are the challenges that they face?
Thank you for asking that. Young men are, well, and I think men in general. So, you know, I work with students on college campuses, but I also work with adults. And so I see these patterns moving from 18 into men I work with, men and women in their 60s and 70s. Men are caught inside of a culture of silence around sex that is incredibly debilitating. So there is, it is, you know, especially on college campuses, it's for a guy to show up to my workshops already is a huge social risk for him to admit that there's something he wants to learn about sex, to admit that he might not know everything, that he doesn't have it all good. I was at Harvard University, and an administrator there, she said when students come to talk about sex, they put their game faces on. And that is what we all do. So they put their game faces on, like, yeah, it's cool. I don't have anything to learn. I'm good. I know what I'm doing. So it's already a huge breaking of a barrier for any man to show up to anything educational around sex, because it admits that he wants to learn something. Men culturally are caught inside of a cultural paradigm of essentially that they're supposed to know what they're doing all of the time. And I had no idea what a heavy weight this was until I started working with and seeing the heaviness of feeling like they're supposed to know what they're doing and they're not allowed to ask a question about it. So the pressure that men feel is tremendous. The performance pressure, the pressure to pursue. I had two young men come to my workshop at an East Coast school, two sports players, and they said, it's exhausting to go to a bar every weekend and have to bring a different person home. That's the expectation. Hmm. It is exhausting. And yet, like, we're freshmen. It's totally what we're supposed to do here. And that there's not a lot of community or ability to speak about sex in a true kind of authentic way for men. There's a lot of locker room talk, sort of throwing things around, but men are inside of so much shame and fear when it comes to their sexual worlds. And, you know, to move into like a little bit more explicit territory, I would say that the fear of premature ejaculation or losing erection is debilitating in its level of fear and shame that holds for men.
Sure.
And that never have they been invited into any other paradigm that allows them to connect with their bodies and understand how their bodies can work differently. That sex isn't just a 70 mile an hour roller coaster ride to ejaculation and then it's over. And so what happens for men when they engage in sexual interactions is so much of their mind and all of their energy is going into avoiding those two things. And this is, you know, I think a dynamic that is responsible for experiences of violation, which is that in order to avoid those two things, penetration happens as quickly as it can in order to avoid those two things.
So what the two things are again?
Premature ejaculation and loss of erection.
Repression. Okay.
Right? Totally. Yeah. No. Yeah. And so, you know, for young men, but this is present in men of all ages, I think, is do this quickly so that I'm not left with the vulnerability of my body doing something unpredictable that I'm not, I don't know what it's going to do. And that is a pressure that is tremendous. Men hold a huge amount of fear and there's not space for them to show emotion. It's even antithetical for them to ask questions. That's what I started seeing on college campuses is there's no one in the room asking questions to say, does this feel good? How is this going? Admits that you don't know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's trying to pretend like they know exactly what they're doing, which is playing out likely an image that was seen on a screen or what they heard from their buddies or what, you know, is being talked about at the lunch table. But nowhere in there is an exploration or actual relating happening that would totally influence those interactions.
Yeah. Boy, I'm remembering back when I was in college, there was a book that was tremendously helpful. I wonder, you know, where are the books in this? There was a book called Love Without Fear. I remember it still. And I read it with my girlfriend. We read it together and we talked about those things as we were moving into a sexual relationship. And that was tremendously helpful, supportive, getting stuff out on the table.
Right.
Where has that gone?
Right. It's not there. I mean, it's not there. What is there is their own Google search for things that they're curious about. And that will lead to incredibly pornographic images and sort of misguided pictures of what sex
actually is. And it keeps escalating. It's like the pornography can't just stay at a certain place. It moves towards violence. It moves towards uglier and uglier kinds of breaking of boundaries. It's like if, you know, just to keep the arousal level up or what?
Yeah, it becomes more explicit, way more explicit. That, you know, it's sort of like needing higher and higher levels of stimulation and explicitness in order to create arousal or sensitivity or any kind of sexual charge.
Yeah.
And that's not natural to us as human beings. That is not natural. And that's not natural to, I'd say, any kid I end up in a room with on a college campus. This is not natural to them, and they know that. And that's where there's this huge gap where they're like, something here feels so off, but I guess that's what I'm supposed to be doing. So, okay, I'll play the game because there's nothing else replacing it. There's nothing inviting them into their own authentic exploration or agency around their sexuality. And I will say on the male question, we're losing men on campus around this, around the way we're dealing with sexual assault, is because most of the men on campus, they feel implicated in that sure. conversation in yeah. a way that puts them on the defensive or right. the I'm going to check out or like, and they are in tremendously in need of sex education. But it's we're polarizing the genders in a major way with sort of the one-sided way we're trying to deal with the sexual culture on college campuses right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm so relieved to hear you say that because I wouldn't quite know how to articulate it, partly because it's so dangerous now as a male to right. to question, you know, say, wait a second, isn't this going too far? Isn't there something lopsided here? But there are many things that are lopsided here.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And the masculine is being really marginalized in a way mm-hmm. where they don't have access to information and education and the spaces that would actually lead them into greater knowledge and understanding something truer in their sexuality that would influence the sexual exchange they have after a party on Friday night.
Yeah.
Like that actually starts to move into their behavior.
Hmm.
I mean, and in no way am I making any excuse for any kind of sexual infraction or violence that's happening
right.
out there. I
right.
want to make that
no.
very, very clear.
Yeah. Sure.
But what I want to say is, when it comes to sex, we are all on a level playing field. And that playing field is the reality that we walk around feeling like we're supposed to know something that we don't. And that we're the only person that knows that thing. And then we try to pretend like we've got it covered. We put our game faces on and we don't talk about it. And in our sexual interactions, we're thinking always that our partner knows what's going on. They are totally comfortable. And the truth is, in our sexuality, no matter if I'm in a room of 19-year-olds or 30 to 70-year-olds, when I make a space that says, hey, there's nothing we're supposed to know, and this isn't about doing it right, and it's okay to feel vulnerable and shy and nervous and have all those things come up, that entire room becomes disarmed almost immediately. That it's no longer functioning from the game face, but then everyone starts to understand, like, yeah, I don't understand what's happening in my body. This is incredibly vulnerable. I am nervous. I am shy. And when they come to understand that those are natural parts of their sexual experience and their sexuality, they're less likely to think that there's a problem happening when they actually get in a room with someone and then try to pretend like we were all good. We got it covered. Close my mouth, just do my thing, you know, or like close my mouth and check out of my body. I mean, the amount of people who leave their bodies and dissociate in sexual encounters is more common than it is not common. And that is a fracture to the spirit. That is a fracture to the psyche. That is a fracture to our wholeness.
Some students must ask you about your own sexuality, just as I'm wondering, you know, what are you doing about all of this in your own life, if I may be so bold?
I mean, I am as vulnerable and a part of this conversation and path as anyone I teach. Like, the fact that I teach sexual work does not mean that I'm no longer vulnerable in my own mm-hmm. in my own sex life. And I mean, I am, you know, I mean I do, you know, I don't feel like I want to just sort of I mean, I'm not in partnership right now.
Okay.
I've come out of partnership with incredible broken heart and all the tending and mending that has had to go into that.
Yeah.
You know, it's me and in my own relationship with my own body and my sexual energy as a single person right now that will move into sexual partnership. But I mean, I'm as inside of this as anyone I teach. And that is what I think makes it so real is mm-hmm. like, we are in this exploration together, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, interestingly enough, like I spend more time talking about sex and sexuality than a lot of things, but I'm incredibly private about my own sexual world, incredibly private, as I encourage my students to be, that there's something sacred in that territory.
Yeah.
That's a private world that deserves a sheltering. And so interestingly enough, I don't actually get a lot of questions from my students about my sex life because, the atmosphere I create in that room creates a tremendous amount of respect for privacy. I never ask somebody about their sex life ever.
Mm-hmm.
I will never ask a question that requires them to give forth a piece of information that violates their own personal boundary of shyness or privacy. And so, I really create an atmosphere that allows them to go into the depths of their own internal universe and memories, biography, longings, desires, relationships. And so there's a really different kind of dynamic that happens in my classrooms, which isn't like, let's just swap sexual stories. Let's talk about personal sexual experiences. Or, I mean, I'm always teaching from a deeply personal place, but that doesn't include me talking about my personal, mm-hmm. like, sex life.
I'm wondering if in your workshops, people get interested in each other in that way, or if it feels like, since all the feeling of vulnerability and danger and so on has been put out there, that maybe that would tend to work against it.
Mm. I would say that the feeling of vulnerability is in the room, but there is no feeling of danger in the room. I want to separate those. I mean vulnerability like the kind of vulnerability it is to look someone in the eye and tell them that you're in love with them. The kind of vulnerability it is to walk through the world with an open heart. I don't mean vulnerability like we're all at risk of something terrible all the time. So there is never an atmosphere of danger in the room. There is actually a tremendous amount of safety and self-trust. But that vulnerability then starts to work on really deep levels for students. And what it's not is like a pickup scene. It's not the common, like, right. Say there's an after-school group where everyone goes in and is swapping stories about sex or whatever, and there's a little bit of that kind of pickup scene going on or checking each other out. That isn't happening. And it's because there's such a deep space created for people to move into their own private worlds. I don't actually bring students into partner exercises. I'm talking now on college campuses, but even there is a highly safe, kind of beautiful openness in the room that is not sexualized. And yeah, maybe two people walk out of there looking at each other and being like, oh, I'm interested in you, or maybe I've seen you around campus. But the energy that's in the room isn't pumping up sexual attraction so mm-hmm. that people are looking around looking at each other. That's part of what I think is really different about what I'm doing yeah. is that it's creating a very different kind of an atmosphere that starts to become sobering for students. And what they walk out with is a deeper level of self-contemplation and discernment around who they are interested in being sexual with, around that it's a bigger deal than just jumping in bed with someone and like going through some motions.
Yeah.
That it's like not about technique and mechanics. And if that's what they think it is, and most of them do because they've never been offered anything different, there's a total feeling at the end of that of like, that, so that's sex. What's the big, why is everyone talking about that? That was not satisfying. That was not, there's got to be something more to this. I think that's something we walk around with as a little bit of a secret, whether it's in our marriages or we're hooking up with people, is like, there's got to be something deeper to this. And I know there is, and I'm not touching it. And where is that possible? Mm-hmm. And how mm-hmm. is that possible?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you spoke about in your TED talk is that colleges in many ways are, they're seeing the intervention as more rules, more guidelines, more things that are written on paper mm-hmm. and that people will be held accountable for and perhaps punished for if they deviate from this. And yet there are people in colleges that are hiring you to come and do, what do they think you're doing? Are you giving them what they thought they were getting? Those administrators who make the decision, okay, let's bring this woman in.
Right. You know, so there's two things I want to say about that question. One is schools gravitate to my work when there is a person on that campus who understands that I'm doing something different and that they need something different. And so at this point in my work, I'm not knocking on anybody's doors. I respond to people who come to me because they've seen my work. They've seen my TEDx talk. They've seen something of my work and they are looking for something different and there's something in it that resonates. The other thing that is a part of the model for my work is that I want it to be, and it largely has been, student driven. I've had more invitations from students mm-hmm. who have gone through the process of finding the funding and getting administrative approval than I have from administrators bringing me to campus.
Interesting.
And to me, that is one of the most powerful, domain-changing, culture-changing things that can happen, is that this is a movement that comes from students who say, we need something different. We are walking around in this. We see what's going on, and we need something, rather than a top-down approach that says, you need something. And that brings a sort of empowerment. And I mean, when students bring me to campus, those workshops always have more students in them than when an administrator brings me to campus, because it comes from the inside.
Yeah.
And I'm very clear about what I'm coming to offer, you know, and I make it very clear that I'm not coming to just teach about blowjobs and masturbation and dildos and sex toys. There's already people coming and teaching about those things, which are perpetuating another kind of pressure when that stuff isn't taught with body sensitivity and with a presence of vulnerability and telling the truth and all of those things, that they understand that this is really something different, and that I don't come in and just give a lecture or just teach one workshop. That isn't going to really shift something. That what I offer is a series of workshops and essentially like what will become a program. This isn't like an hour and a half thing and then we wipe our hands clean and say we did our sex education for the year. That is not education. So, and that nothing is going to shift inside of that. So I would say schools, students, and administrators who contact me, they're aware that something they're doing isn't working and they've reached out to other people to educate on their campuses and they still feel like something there is not working. So it's self-selecting in a certain way.
Yeah, you know, I'm sort of looking for the glimmer of light or hope in all this, and it seems like that might be in those students who are reaching out to other students who are realizing that that there's something missing. And perhaps, you know, you started out speaking about the pendulum that swings this way and that way, and mm-hmm. maybe there will be an endogenous welling up of a sense of we need something deeper, something more authentic, and maybe that will be student-driven.
I feel a tremendous sense of hope in all of this, David, because I think it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable. And that there are people on every campus who are, whether it's an economics professor or a coach or a student or someone who's not necessarily in, you know, working with sexual assault on campus, maybe it is those people who is like, hey, I want to be a part of something different. I can see something that's happening here. And like, the change is inevitable if we open the door to bring something different in, because those students know that it's not, that they're not engaging in something that feels natural to them. They aren't, it's not working for them and they know it, but they're not being given something different. I have no doubt that like this is, I really believe we are on the edge of a sexual revolution that starts with a sort of truth telling around how dissatisfied we are with the way we're engaging in that. And that we are looking for creative inroads to something very different that is going to come in a different kind of package than the normal way that we institutionally respond to things, which is with handbooks and policy and rules and, you know, like, that's not sex. Sex is not an academic issue. Sex at root is not a legal issue. Yes, we need legislation to hold people accountable. Absolutely. But we, as institutions, as academic institutions, to solve this problem, we have to start thinking like human beings, not as academics.
You know, I think that's a perfect wrap-up for our discussion here. It's a good, strong statement. So, unless you've got something else you feel you need to say, I'm going to suggest that that we draw it to a close here.
No, thank you, David. It's great to talk to you. I appreciate you reaching out.
Yeah, I feel very energized by our conversation and by what you're doing. And so, Sarah Burden, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. The thing that really impressed me in this interview with Sarah Burden is her intense commitment to authentic presence. Clearly, that's the secret sauce in her success engaging college students and others at a deep level about their sexual anxieties. And who doesn't have them these days? The sexual encounter seems more politicized and entangled with legal considerations than ever. The daily revelations of men in power abusing their privilege is either shocking or old hat, depending on your perspective. The fact that the tide has turned so quickly, though, in holding them accountable is the real news. Most men are not rapists or sexual abusers, but these headlines cause us all, men and women alike, to question ourselves and to wonder if there might be ways that we might unconsciously participate in this dance. Where's the innocence? Where's the safety? Can we risk the vulnerability? I'm impressed that Sarah is able to hold a compassionate understanding for the challenges faced by men, even while condemning those who trespass legal and moral boundaries. I also felt I learned something in relation to the complexities of consent. Is consent under pressure really consent? If the pressure is an internalized bowing to, conforming to peer pressure or societal pressure, is that truly consent? There are a number of topics I'd prepared questions on that I didn't get around to. It was clear to me, even before our interview, having seen Sarah's TED presentation, that she's fiercely committed to being authentic, honest, and in the moment. I felt challenged, as I often do in these interviews, to be as real as I can be and to meet her in that place. And that means abandoning my scripted questions and getting into the flow of the moment. I'm happy to say that really happened in this interview, and I could feel that it was mutual. I did struggle with whether to ask Sarah something about her own sexuality. I took that risk, and then given her initial response, began to have second thoughts. But she staked out her boundaries and then gave us just enough for me to be glad that I did go there. It didn't seem to have ruptured our relationship. If we had more time, I would have gone on to ask her about her notions of sacred sexuality, sexual healing, and some of her other involvements that are hinted at on her website at theelementalself.com. We had a good conversation after the recorder was turned off, and I felt very enlivened by my contact with this intensely dynamic woman.
Hi there, my name's Faye. I'm from London in the UK. I decided to make a $5 donation to Dr. Dave's podcast because I'm learning a lot from it, and spent about $40 a month on books and learning. So hey, why not $5 to such an interesting podcast? Thanks so much for doing the work you do.
Thank you, Faye in London, for that sterling endorsement. 'Tis the season for giving. Enough said. And of course, that's a reference to Christmas, and I should hasten to let you know that I won't be conducting an interview next week or putting out a podcast episode. I'm also not sure if I'll get our newsletter out for January. I'm planning a trip to New Hampshire for a week to visit my old friend and past guest, Dr. Dwight Webb, so that may cause a brief lull in my output. I am happy to announce two new transcripts. Number 539, The Lies We Tell Ourselves with John Frederickson, MSW. And that one's thanks to Mayar Alenagi. And we also have a transcript for number 534, Your Mind is Bigger Than Your Brain with Daniel J. Siegel, MD, thanks to Fizey Crofts. In fact, going over that interview with Dan Siegel prompts me to add it to my Best of Shrink Wrap Radio list on the main page on our site under the category Mind. And with that, I think I'll wrap it up once again for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and remember that you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use the Shrink Wrap Radio app to do that. Thanks to today's guest, Sarah Burden, for sharing her experiences and perspective on sex education. My next guest will be Anne and Joanne Watts, and we'll be speaking about their recently published collection of the letters of their father, Alan Watts, the noted and influential Buddhist writer and speaker. With luck, I'll probably get this one out the week of January 2nd. In the meantime, I wish you all, dear listeners, peaceful and joyful holidays. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.